Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Here's the argument. Both sides of the human cloning debate, those in favor of cloning for medical research and those against all human cloning, miss the larger issue of the genetics revolution. Advances in biotechnology threaten to undermine our essential humanity, the very qualities that define who we are as a species. So says political philosopher Francis Fukuyama in his new book, Our Post-Human Future. Science and technology have propelled human development for the last 500 years. Now, says Francis Fukuyama, genetic engineering and mood-altering drugs threaten to fundamentally change human nature and the underpinnings of liberal democracy. 10 years ago, Fukuyama described the end of history. Now he warns of a frightening, brave new world. What happens when, through the miracle of genetic engineering, all humans are not created equal? Where should we draw the line between scientific advancement and scientific encroachment? In the largest sense, are we headed for a post-human future? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining us now from Washington is Francis Fukuyama. He's professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Our Post-Human Future, Consequences of the Biotechnology Revolution. Earlier this year, he was appointed to President Bush's Council on Bioethics. Good evening and welcome, Francis Fukuyama.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Vermont Public Radio is Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Francis Fukuyama, it's a big word and one most of us may never have heard or used before, post-human. What do you mean by a post-human future?
Well, for the 100,000 or so years that the human race has existed, it's been fairly genetically constant. There hasn't been much modification, but with human cloning, for the first time, you're going to be able to specify in advance the genetic makeup of a child. And looking down the road, you are going to be able to start modifying that genetic makeup in certain ways that will be then passed on to all of the subsequent descendants of the child that you modify. So you're really beginning a period in which it may become possible to really affect who we are in the most basic ways that will change the nature, or potentially could change the nature of the human species over time.
What kinds of changes are you concerned about, and what sort of consequences might they have in your view?
Let me say, first of all, your setup, I think, made the future sound a little bit more threatening than I really intended, because I do think that
post-humans has a vaguely ominous sound about it.
Oh, yes, you're right. Okay, I'm guilty of that, I guess. But, you know, there are clearly therapeutic uses of this technology that are extremely promising. Stem cells will lead the way to regenerative medicine. A lot of genetically linked diseases may ultimately be cured or stopped before they start by germline genetic engineering, and so there is a lot of promise to this. But I think where it gets a little bit problematic is when you move from the traditional therapeutic uses of medicine to you might call enhancement uses, in which you're not simply seeking to correct a genetic defect, but to improve other qualities of human beings. And this is where I think you start entering into some fairly grave issues having to do with human equality and the kind of natures that we have that, I, in my view, are the basis of our rights, our political rights.
Yeah, Francis Fukuyama, I have to say, what I've read that you've written sounds more than a little bit problematic. You're writing about fundamentally changing human nature in a way, as you describe it, that would pull away the underpinnings of everything that we achieved in your end of history estimation 10 years ago. That sounds like a pretty frightening prospect.
Well, I think it is, and that's why I think that we ought to pay attention to what's going on in the life sciences. It turns out, you know, that the human species is actually a genetically fairly homogeneous species. As little as a couple hundred years ago, when the Declaration of Independence was written that declared that all men were created equal, we in fact did not grant equal political rights to African Americans and to women on the grounds that they were not fully human beings. And as recently as the 1920s or 30s, you had doctrines of scientific racism that purported to show that there were genetic differences that justified differentiating the rights that you granted to different classes of individuals. And one of the great, I think, achievements of 20th century democracy is to debunk the empirical basis of a lot of those claims. But the technology that is opening up, you know, really opens up the possibility, for example, of the creation of a class of enhanced versus non-enhanced human beings that will, you know, in many respects potentially undo I regard as the 20th century's achievements in terms of political equality.
So you're saying that in a very material, real way, it would no longer be true that all people are created equal, that genetic engineering could actually create a kind of superclass of humans?
Well, that's one possibility. You know, Thomas Jefferson, in a letter that he wrote just before he died in 1824, said that our political equality in the United States is due to the fact that nature had contrived it, that some people are not born with saddles on their backs and other people born booted and spurred to ride them. And I think that, you know, that empirical fact is in a politically very relevant one. Now, there are lots of ways that this could work out that will be, you know, less dramatic that I think will also produce some pretty important changes, for example, in life extension or the, you know, the use of various kinds of drugs and other technologies that will enable us to control or manipulate human behavior. And again, these are not as dramatic as, you know, altering our natures and therefore the nature of our rights, but they do open up the possibility of certain kinds of social engineering that by the end of the 20th century we had largely rejected because, in a way, human nature was itself too intractable, or at least that was, I think, the lesson of that we took away from the utopian politics of the last couple of centuries.
So, Francis Fukuyama, we understand there's all kinds of gradations here, but so that we have clarity about what really keeps you up at night, describe for us, and we can work backward from there, I guess, but describe for us the scenario in terms of genetic engineering, mind-altering drugs. First of all, physically, what do you mean by enhanced human beings, and what's your real nightmare scenario there? And how would that, in your mind, then play through to our politics, our interactions, our social life, our very humanity?
Well, there are several ways that this could proceed, and you know, by the way, there's no guarantee that any of this will happen.
It could understood. Be that, understood.
You know, the technology may never pan out. But for example, just in terms of equality, who are the first people that are going to make use of a expensive and difficult technology to enhance, let's say, the intelligence of their children? It will obviously be well-to-do people or social elites who will then try to embed those advantages, not just socially or through education or resources, but will try to embed those advantages genetically in their children. And this either could widen existing inequalities in a qualitative way, or it could produce a kind of backlash. I mean, if you want a scenario for the state getting involved in eugenics again, I think this is a pretty good one. That's one possibility. Another, I think, way of altering our natures is through life extension. This is one of those possibilities that you know is only a possibility at this point, but there are molecular biologists who seriously think there may be a common a genetic cause of the body having a natural lifespan, a fixed natural lifespan, and that could be altered in some possibly dramatic way. And again, I think that this poses a very difficult challenge for human nature because our human experience is very much caught up in generational succession and institutions and societies and in many ways, progress itself are really dependent on the appearance of natural generational succession. So again, this is a, you know, a very...
You mean that is of an older generation making way for younger generations?
Well, sure. I mean, if you have people living not just as now into their 70s and 80s, but into their 90s, 100s, and so forth, you will have great grandfathers competing for the same jobs with their great grandchildren. You just look around the world at all of the age-graded hierarchies that dominate our society, and you'll see that none of these work under those conditions.
And if we should end up with a bioengineered class then of humans who live longer, think better, run faster, I don't know, enhanced in many dimensions, you're saying this is a threat also to our political system?
Well, yes, and let me give you a couple of examples. I mean, when you talk about run faster and are smarter, this sort of thing, it's not that controversial to say that you're improving people. But supposing that you had a means in the privacy of your doctor's office to guarantee that your child would have no genetic predisposition to being gay, or you could change the skin color of your child, or, you know, other characteristics like that, would you say under those conditions that that's an improvement in the human race? And I think, actually, if you think through that particular scenario, that since parents, most parents actually want grandchildren and want quote-unquote normal kids, I would imagine that, again, if done, you know, even very unprejudiced parents, if they could make this choice in the privacy of their doctor's offices, would probably, you know, opt against having gay children. And that, I think, you know, indicates that it's not really clear what constitutes improvement of the human race. A lot of these categories are very politically controversial. And I think, in fact, that when it comes to doing things like manipulating the emotional gamut of we human beings, you know, trying to take apart these complete human beings and restructure them to make them happier, we are not going to know what we're doing. I think the likelihood of unintended consequences, you know, when you start doing that, and the opportunities for, I think, politically or ideologically motivated, you know, attempts to manipulate human personality are really very great.
Jack Beattie, Francis Fukuyama is careful to say that it doesn't have to turn out this way, that this is not a surefire prediction, but it's a real Frankenstein's lab scenario that he's painting here at the furthest reaches.
Yeah, I mean, and he's using the language, he just used the phrase, logic of unintended consequences. And, of course, we've heard this. This is a standard conservative position about almost any innovation in any area. But let's imagine some intended consequences. For example, Alzheimer's disease. I would sacrifice a good deal I'm much more fearful of someone suffering from Alzheimer's disease than I am of sort of losing my freedom in some posited future that won't happen. In other words, we won't get to the Alzheimer's solution or the Parkinson's or any of these scourges if we ban these techniques. So in the name of these posited dangers, he wants to prevent us from reaching these possible benefits. And I think this is we can all be lofty, and I share many of his fears. But let's be real here. I mean, one of my closest friends, the most vivid woman I've ever known, is suffering from Parkinson's. She can't move. I couldn't go to her and say, you know, in the future, this could lead to tyranny, unintended consequences, so we can't do the research that could free you from this fetter. Human beings are not only, you know, assailed through manipulation, they're assailed by nature. And the relief of man's estate, that's what Francis Bacon calls science. And we need our estate to be relieved from immemorial scourges that have limited human freedom immemorially.
But Francis Fukuyama, you make the point that it's this very terrific attraction of the possibility of addressing some of these scourges and lesser afflictions that will lead humans to open a door to all kinds of secondary effects that will be negative.
Well, sure. That's the problem in general with biotechnology, that, you know, unlike nuclear weapons, which everyone can see are very dangerous, this is something where you have some fairly subtle dangers and problems wrapped up in things that are obviously very good. And incidentally, I don't, you know, want to ban any of those futures like you're suggesting. I think that, you know, what we need is a system of regulation that allows us precisely to come up with a cure for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, you know, using these technologies. That you know, keeps them focused on, I think, fairly clearly therapeutic ends. And I think that that is possible. I think that it is possible for societies to design political and regulatory institutions that allow them to discriminate between uses of the technology that will be beneficial and those that that will not. And so I think this question of, you know, wanting to stop research in Alzheimer's is a red herring.
Well, we'll come and talk about that in some more detail, because, of course, there's legislation out there right now that would have a material effect on it. Is there not, Francis Fukuyama?
Yes, that's right. Now, there's a discussion in the Senate right now over a couple of different human cloning bans.
And you sit on the President's Commission on Bioethics, so there's a lot to talk about tonight. We're talking with Francis Fukuyama. 10 years ago, he was writing about the end of history in The Last Man. Now he's writing about a genetically engineered future that you might not recognize and might not like if you do. How much can we tinker with our human qualities and still be human beings? Do we risk engineering ourselves right out of our humanity? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about what advances in biotechnology will mean for the future of what it means to be human. Our guest tonight is Francis Fukuyama, author of the new book, Our Post-Human Future, Consequences of the Biotechnology Revolution. 10 years ago, the fictional couple Harry and Louise appeared in several commercials that undermined the Clinton health care plan. Now they're back in a new ad opposing congressional bills that limit stem cell research.
What's with this stem cell research debate?
A lot of people in Congress have their facts confused.
Oh, I'm shocked.
One bill puts scientists in jail for working to cure our niece's diabetes.
So, cure cancer, go to jail.
Alzheimer's, heart disease, take your pick.
Well, is it cloning?
No, it uses an unfertilized egg and a skin cell.
So, it's not making babies.
Just life-saving cures.
And for that, we go to jail.
And we should log on and tell Congress. They can stop human cloning without stopping life-saving research.
In response to the Harry and Louise ads, the conservative group Stop Human Cloning released a parody commercial featuring Harry and Louise clones, Harriet and Louis, that paints a more dire view of the future of biomedical research.
Louis, did you see that ad on TV about cloning?
The one with the couple who look just like us?
Spooky, huh?
You don't suppose they're really clones, do you?
Who knows? It seems like some biotech companies will do just about anything to make a buck.
Yeah.
Did you know they want to get patents on human clones, just like they do on lab animals?
But their ad says they're only using a human egg and skin cell.
Well, that's how you make a clone.
But they also say cloning is needed to cure terrible diseases.
Look, if they were really interested in cures, they'd be talking about adult stem cell research, which shows far more promise, not creating embryos to destroy them for medical experiments.
What can we do to stop them?
Well, there is a Senate bill that bans all human cloning.
But not life-saving research?
Oh, of course not. It's the bill President Bush supports. We need to call Senator Tim Johnson at 202-224-3121 and ask him to vote for the Brownback Landrieu bill.
Hey, Harriet.
Uh-huh?
Your sister's here.
Sister? I don't have a sister.
That was a new ad by the conservative group Stop Human Cloning. Listeners, we're talking with Francis Fukuyama tonight. We'll talk about the legislation that's on the table, but also about his vision of a much bigger horizon where genetic engineering really gets out of control. The question is, how much can we tinker with our human qualities and still be human? Do we risk creating genetically engineered haves and have-nots, mutants and supermen? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Francis Fukuyama, let's get right down to the current issues for just a moment. We want to get back to your big picture, but where do you stand on the legislation that Congress has been wrestling with about stem cell research and human cloning?
I was very much in favor of stem cell research under the guidelines that the NIH had set down, which meant you derive them from embryos, from leftover embryos from IVF clinics, that there was informed consent. There are a variety of conditions, including no deliberate creation of embryos for research purposes. Now, I have supported the broader Brownback-Landrieu bill that would also ban therapeutic cloning that's now being considered in the Senate, but I have to be careful explaining why I do this. I don't come at this from a pro-life position, which is what motivates, I think, a lot of supporters of that bill.
Okay.
In my view, I think that an embryo doesn't have the moral status of an infant, but it is definitely something human, and I think that you cross a certain threshold when you deliberately create that something human. And I think that what I'm worried about more are a series of slippery slopes, and these are not just theoretical possibilities. In the stem cell debate, one of the conditions, for stem cell research going forward, which the supporters of this research swore up and down they would never violate, was no deliberate creation of embryos for this kind of research. Mm. Senator Arlen Specter, was supporting this, promised, a year and a half ago that this would never happen. And then when the research community decided that this was necessary, immediately that condition, falls away. And so you've already, it didn't take, more than a week or two to fall down that particular slippery slope. And so, I think there's a precedent for, these firebreaks not working terribly well. And so I would think that what you would need if this kind of research is to go forward is to put it into a regulatory framework that would prevent, for example, 5 years down the road, someone saying, well, actually what we need are whole organs or tissues out of a fetus that is grown deliberately for that purpose, up to the age of, 3, 4, 5 months. And by the way, what's wrong with doing this since we already grow embryos for the sake of harvesting the stem cells? What's the difference between a 4-month-old fetus and a 2-day-old embryo? Because in principle, you're doing the same thing. And that, the latter scenario would make people much more nervous, and I think, rightly so. And so I think if you can encase, this kind of research in the appropriate kinds of controls to prevent that sort of thing from happening, I think, I would be willing to see it go ahead.
Jack Beattie, there's Francis Fukuyama on the current legislation. Does it make you more confident that you'd be permitted the Alzheimer's cure that everyone would like to see in the Fukuyama view of the world?
Well, I don't know anything about biology, so I'm not. I really can't say, but I do know.
We're really talking. We're talking regulation here, though.
I understand. But when I said earlier that Francis was opposed, wanted to ban things on putative grounds, unintended consequences, ban things that were good, and it would not come to pass because of the ban. I meant just this: the ban on therapeutic cloning, which is a bill sponsored by Senator Kennedy and Senator Feinstein of California that would allow that to go forward. And according to and I took my information from the Baltimore Sun, which says that this is essential, or that this sort of research is needed to have regenerative medicine work. Now, if that's the case, then I think we do see a situation here where, again, distant dangers and dangers that are projections of, some out of science fiction. Aldous Huxley is sort of the godfather of this book. And I'm not saying they're unwarranted, but do we really want to make policy on the basis of things that could come to pass when the consequence of doing that is to deny the relief of man's estate?
Francis Fukuyama, what about it? Have you been reading too much Orwell and Huxley late at night?
Well, first of all, the promise is simply promise. I mean, nobody knows whether this research is going to pan out and to what extent, the cloning of embryos is going to be necessary for all of these cures. I mean, that's a possibility. I'm not a scientist either, and I don't know whether that's going to happen. But you can't assume that it has already happened either as a basis of making policy. But I think, as I said, there are ways of going ahead with it. That slow down, and I guess the real problem is, this problem of desensitization, that you say, well, these worries are very, hypothetical, distant ones, and you have, very tangible, real things you're gaining in the short run. Well, maybe they're real and tangible, maybe not, but in the process, you cross, a whole series of thresholds, and each one is a kind of imperceptible one, but over time, you put yourself in a position where you are really you've legitimated in a way that where you can't really wind back the clock the manufacture of human beings. And that, I think, is maybe a long-term concern, but it's a very important one.
Listeners, Francis Fukuyama is not shy about describing the potential risks here. He says these developments will be hugely controversial because they will challenge dearly held notions of human equality and the capacity for moral choice. They'll give societies new techniques for controlling the behavior of their citizens. They will change our understanding of human personality and identity. They will upend existing social hierarchies and affect the rate of social, material, and political progress. We're talking about the whole shebang under the bioengineering microscope here. Can we harness the benefits of genetic engineering without corrupting human nature? Or are we fighting paradise out of fear of the future? Frank is on the line. Welcome, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to point out that all those horror scenarios you just went through a moment ago are already happening, and that the genetic engineering and the medicinal alteration of human nature, I don't think, is any more alarming than what already happens in the human economy. Look, we have technology that advances who stays alive and who doesn't, who makes out in society and who doesn't. Those things, to me, seem to be just as powerful a set of effects as genetic engineering. And
so, Frank, are you saying bring on the genetic engineering future or put on the brakes?
No, I'm saying let what may happen happen, and don't be so alarmed. The other point I think is related to this is our human natures are not going to change beyond what we already see in the population. So if you're talking about selecting for superhumans, you know, you're going to be selecting traits to enhance based on what we already see in the population. Is that so alarming? For instance, if we are afraid of creating a superhuman race of smarter kids or stronger kids, the level of those enhancements is going to be about what we see in the population anyhow.
Let's put that to Francis Fukuyama. We take your point, Frank, and thank you for your call. Francis Fukuyama, how about it? Frank says this is just good breeding.
Well, I mean, I don't know why you assume that it has to come from, you know, a trait from some other human being. I mean, in agricultural biotechnology, they do this, you know, cross-species recombinant DNA all the time. They'll put a jellyfish gene into a, you know, into a corn plant to give it fluorescence, or they've even put it into, you know, into certain kinds of mammals. And so, you know, there's all sorts of genes that you can mix in. And, you know, there are other possibilities for human-animal hybrids, I think, that will be necessitated by certain kinds of, you know, research. I mean,
you've written about a concern of half man, half ape. Why would anyone do that?
Well, I'm not sure that anyone would do that, but, you know, just think about regenerative medicine, the need to create, you know, entire new organs. How are you going to create them? I mean, it seems to me that you've got to grow them basically in an animal host of some sort. And so then you've got the prospect of an animal being bred, you know, specifically to have certain, you know, very distinctively human characteristics. And so that's another line that, you know, is out there waiting to be crossed.
But I think, if I could just make one analogy.
Sure. I mean, I don't think it's just conservatives that worry about unintended consequences. I'll give you a good example. Hydroelectric power. If you go back to these propaganda films that were made about the building of Hoover Dam in the 1930s, it's very Stalinist, you know, and they're talking about this great conquest of nature. Cheap electricity will come from the damming of this powerful river, and this shows how man can master nature and so forth. And what we find is that in the past 30, 40 years, not a single developed country has initiated a large hydroelectric project like that, precisely because we now understand that there are all of these unforeseen environmental consequences that came with this, I think, very naive attempt to conquer nature. And and that's something that, you know, environmentalists worry about all the time. And so I think it's not simply a right-wing concern. I think that, in fact, there are a lot of parallels between the, you know, the natural ecology, the non-human natural ecology, and, you know, the ecology of human genes, that we will be in danger of making similar kinds of mistakes in when we move into that realm.
But Francis Fukuyama, has perhaps our technology capacity brought us to the place where two wings of human nature are now in conflict? I mean, you write persuasively about a potential threat to human nature when we get bioengineered out of recognition. On the other hand, it's just this kind of scientific and technological development that is a hallmark of the species, is it not?
Well, we've never had this particular capability before, so I don't know, you know, I mean, what constitutes a hallmark of this species?
Well, this particular capability, but we've always been searching for the new technology, whether it's in irrigation or in, I mean, you name it. Isn't it part of human nature to search, to take the stone and make it into a tool, and millennia later, we're bioengineering?
Well, we always innovate technologically. That does not mean that we don't try to control a lot of the technological innovations. I mean, the environmental regulation is all about controlling the bad consequences of industrial era technology. So, nuclear weapons are a technological innovation that, you know, maybe we had to create, but we do everything we can politically to keep these things under control. So, I mean, I don't Mm-hmm. You know, it just seems to me you can't possibly argue that everything technological that's possible to do, we will inevitably do, regardless of whether that's good or bad for, you know, for human life. I think all human beings like technology. They like the good things that it brings, but all societies also try to exercise a certain amount of judgment and control as to which ones really do benefit our human ends and which are destructive of it.
We can only imagine the tension that will be around controlling this vast horizon that's coming up. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I want to point out that I feel that this whole discussion is going in a very wrong direction.
Okay.
And Tom, you and Jack have been focusing on the making it seem like Professor Fukuyama is being an alarmist. And in fact, as I hear what he's saying and what you, as you quote from the book, what he's really saying is that this is something we need to have our eyes open towards. That we need to, as we go forward, we need to see that there's a possibility that this is coming up and we need to plan in advance. And I think of what's going on in artificial reproductive technologies, and we now have a bevy of lawsuits and policy problems, and this is a small issue compared to what's going on.
So, David, you're with Francis Fukuyama here. Let's
Well, I'm actually all I'm saying is that you're characterizing it as a very alarmist view. And I think what we need to do, and what Professor Fukuyama is apparently doing, is alerting us that this is something we have to have our eyes open to and need to have a structure. I'm not suggesting that I agree with him so much as that he's opening our eyes to the problem.
Yeah, I think it's not so much necessarily that it's an alarmist view, but it is an alarming view of what could emerge here, at least as I read the book. Francis Fukuyama, where is the line between alarming and alarmist?
Well, the caller actually stated my position quite well. I mean, I'm not terrified of this technology, but I do think that, you know, there's a kind of blithe and I think rather naive boosterism about it that characterizes a lot of people in the biotech industry and in the research community. And
you're right that you're afraid that will lead to traditional breaks on going over the cliff not being on because there's such an economic interest in this going ahead.
There's a huge economic self-interest, and I think, you know, in the research community, the level of disinterest has fallen because, you know, there are very few scientists that now don't have, you know, some kind of personal stake in a biotech company. And, you know, that's not bad. I mean, that's the way capitalist economies work. People want to make money, and so that's not illegitimate. But it does mean that the interests of that community don't necessarily correspond to the public interest. And that's, you know, a classic case where you need some kind of, you know, higher degree of regulatory oversight. And that's all I'm saying, you know, we need to think about right now.
And you're saying a much tougher oversight, even regulation, that there has been a kind of international superagency perhaps at some point to keep track of what's going on all over the world.
Well, that's a little bit premature, but I think, for example, the FDA cannot introduce ethical considerations into its, it has no statutory authority to consider any kinds of ethical considerations. Furthermore, it can't regulate procedures like IVF. It's claimed an authority over cloning on the grounds that a cloned embryo is a medical product, which it does have authority over, but I think legally that's quite questionable. The NIH, the National Institutes of Health, have a lot of rules, but those only apply to federally funded research, which leaves the entire private biotech industry outside of its scope. And so I think there are a lot of holes in the current regulatory structure that will need to be filled and rationalized in the future.
Francis Fukuyama, stand by. We're talking about Francis Fukuyama's new book, Our Post-Human Future. If we're all genetically nipped and tucked and drugged, will we still be human? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Francis Fukuyama about his new book, Our Post-Human Future, a future where he worries we may follow bioengineering right off a cliff. Do we risk engineering ourselves right out of our humanity? Might we breed a subset of genetic superheroes at the expense of fundamental human equality? And on the medical front, is even suffering a necessary component of human nature, of human dignity? Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Ed is on the line. Welcome, Ed. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Good evening, gentlemen.
Evening.
I have a question for Professor Fukuyama, and it's along the line of the unintended result argument. It's kind of a two-part question, if
okay.
I may.
Okay.
The first part is... I far from feeling alarmed, I don't feel that, and I haven't listened to the whole show, so forgive me if I've missed something, but I don't hear anything other than speculation about unintended results from the use of this kind of research. It seems to me to reduce to a very simple warning that my grandmother might have given me going out the door when I was a little kid. You know, it's dangerous out there, be careful. And the second part is along the line of the use of, when he was discussing the use of that research for the cure of different diseases, mm-hmm. with regard to unintended results, it seemed to me that he was saying that we shouldn't pursue, use this research for those diseases. I was wondering if there was any kind of research that could be done that wouldn't have unintended results. And is that really a reason to dump this kind of research? And
Ed, we got it. Let's put it to Francis Fukuyama. I guess, first of all, and we talked about this earlier in the hour a bit, but let's keep the edge clear here, Francis Fukuyama. The keen edge of your warning is simply that this can go too far, but it's not a simple argument. You're saying human nature itself may be vulnerable if genetic engineering goes too far.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a kind of pragmatic utilitarian set of problems, and then there's a more essential set of problems. The unintended consequences, you know, are more in the former category, that genetic engineering on human beings is going to be much more risky than drugs, let's say, because, you know, there's only at this point, they think, 30,000 genes. It means that genetic causation is extremely complex. A single gene will have multiple effects. Multiple genes interact to have a single effect. And so the likelihood that if you try to manipulate, you know, one thing, you'll end up doing a lot of other things, I think, is really fairly high. So I think that there's some reason for thinking that unintended consequences, and therefore your ability to test for them in clinical trials, is going to be much more difficult when you get to this kind of technology than in the case of something like drugs. But the bigger issue is, even if there aren't intended consequences and we are able to use this technology safely and effectively, I think that in a way poses the even bigger problem, because that presupposes that we understand what it is we want to modify about our natures, what it is that we think we are doing when we improve a human being. And as I said, I think there are certain areas where that's relatively unambiguous. I don't see many downsides from people getting smarter. But, you know, when you talk about, the range of human emotions and human personality, then I think you get into some very dicey territory.
And you make this interesting argument that if we run away from sorrow, from fear, from pain, from all the negatives, we will lose something that is essential to being human.
Well, see, we do this already with drugs. I mean, if you take a drug like Ritalin, which is a form of amphetamine, it's used to treat this condition called ADHD, attention mm-hmm. deficit hyperactivity
very widely.
Disorder, which is not, in fact, a disease. It is simply the description of a tale of a normal distribution of human behaviors having to do with, you know, being able to sit still and concentrate and the like. And when you get far enough out into that tale, it becomes, something that keeps you from functioning. And so the drug has, I think, a very important therapeutic value. But it, in my view, is overprescribed, and it is used as a medical substitute for what we traditionally understood to be character building, which is to say putting off short-term gratifications in favor of longer ones, instilling in yourself a certain sense of discipline, and that requiring a lot of labor-intensive activity on the parts of parents and teachers. And, you know, now there is a medical shortcut that gets around it. And this is, that's an example, I think, of one of the subtle ways that medical technology undermines traditional moral understandings of, you know, what it means to be human, precisely because it gives you this kind of technological shortcut around, you know, some of those pains and difficulties. I mean, you know, nobody gets elected to Congress arguing that we need more pain and suffering, but, you know, part of the human experience is learning how to deal with that kind of, that side of human life, and I think
Jack Beatty.
Yes, but life has enough grindstone in it without disease. Life has enough sorrow in it without diseases that could be dealt with. through dealing with the sort of the basic program of life. Medicine has been in the kindergarten stage of science until now. We're just now getting to the point where fundamental processes are understood. And in the name of these lofty considerations, the commission of which Francis is a part is saying no to all this.
As a factual matter, the commission has a wide range of views on this. We have not issued a report, and I don't think when the report comes out, it's actually going to reflect a wide range of views.
Well, I hope so, because the commission began with a story from Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Birthmark, about a scientist who marries a woman who has a birthmark and then sets about trying to eliminate it, to perfect her. Well, that's a loaded proposition. Suppose she had had Parkinson's disease. Would we have said that it was trying to perfect human nature to eliminate that? Not at all. So I think that the aura of that commission and its heavy representation of people who are very prone to the unintended consequences logic, I don't think it augurs for a very fair-minded report.
Francis Fukuyama, we've just got a minute left, but can we have it both ways? Can we go hell for leather for using all this technology to address the kinds of diseases Jack is raising without getting onto the slippery slope you're describing?
Well, we'll have to see, but I'm actually more optimistic than a lot of people about our ability to design institutions that will allow us to make discriminations between good and bad uses of technology that take into account, very complex issues and not stop the good things that Jack is interested in pursuing. So I guess I don't really see what the problem is, and certainly this council is not going to stop anything. I mean, we're just, it's engaged in trying to discuss the issues fully and fairly. But
yeah. And that you've done and got our attention again in your every 10 years way or less. Francis Fukuyama, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Francis Fukuyama is author of Our Post-Human Future, Consequences of the Biotechnology Revolution. In a moment, the futurist's version of A Day at the Track. If you've got $1,000 that says by the year 2020, tickets for a trip to the moon will be available at your local travel agents, we've got the website for you. Longbets.com was created by famed futurist Stuart Brand and friends as a forum where people can place binding long-term wagers on what might otherwise seem like rampant speculation. Some of the nation's brightest lights in science, technology, and social criticism have placed 10, 20, 50-year bets on propositions ranging from artificial intelligence to 150-year-old humans. I recently spoke with Stuart Brand and asked him about the purpose of Long Bets.
We call them accountable predictions, and it's just a place where people can make predictions in competition with other people's predictions with real money on the table. And Long Bets Foundation provides the follow-through to be sure that the whole thing goes to completion and the winner gets applauded and the loser noticed. And the idea is to improve long-term thinking.
Any minimum rules, or how does it work?
Minimum bet is $1,000. The minimum period is 2 years. Deal is the odds are always even, and there's always a win-lose outcome. And the bets have to be societally or scientifically important. And the money eventually goes to charity, so the bettors need to provide the name of a charity they'd like the money to go to if they win. And then the money goes into a fund where it grows over time, so it may be significant money at the end of a seriously long bet.
And as you say, one of your rules is that the subjects of the bet have to be societally or scientifically important. That makes it interesting, but why did you make that a precondition?
Because this really is about thinking seriously about the future, and I think bets about sports or about what celebrity is going to get pregnant next or something like that don't really tell us much about either anything to do with responsibility or long-term thinking in a serious way. People are making these bets are not making guesses. They're not playing odds. They actually have a theory of how the world works, and the bet expresses that theory, and then the world will show if they're right or wrong.
Take us on a tour. what's the range of things people are betting about?
Because it got a launch in Wired magazine this month, there's a number of high-tech people in it. So, for example, there's a bet on the Turing test that by 2029, 27 years from now, a computer or machine intelligence will pass the Turing test of machine intelligence, which is where a computer pretending to be a human as you communicate with it, you can't tell if it's a human or a machine. Mitch Kapor, who started Lotus 1-2-3, started the bet. He said that's not going to happen by then. Ray Kurzweil, a serious technology pusher who's done great books on the subject like The Age of Spiritual Machines, said no, it will happen. And then the two of them spelled out a series of tests that can be made over the period of time. And Mitch has to win all three times, but they each put up $10,000.
And here's a borderline bet. I have to say, Ted Danson and Mike Elliott betting on whether the U.S. men's soccer team will win the World Cup before the Red Sox win the World Series. Judges, how did you permit this bet?
I love that bet. I love the way it's stated. It's so clear. I love that it could happen this year or it could happen never. And the reason it's not just an ordinary sports bet is that, as you read in the arguments, Mike Elliott, for example, is saying that this is about kind of globalization trends and population trends, especially immigration in the U.S. We are getting more and more people who grew up playing soccer coming into the U.S., and they expect to play soccer and soccer moms and all the rest of it.
So if you can make a good enough argument around social terms, you may sneak even a sports question onto the list.
You got it. Yeah.
And what does it mean when there's no end date on the bet? I see here there's one between Nathan Myhrvold, who, of course, was the big technologist at Microsoft for years and years, and Danny Hillis. The bet is the universe will eventually stop expanding. Myhrvold says no. Danny Hillis says yes. But there's only a question mark on the date of the bet's end. What's that mean?
It means that in this case, what they're both waiting for is basically agreement among astrophysicists of the value of what some call omega. And if omega is greater than 1, then Danny wins because it expands so far and then falls back on itself. And if it's less than 1, then Nathan wins because it just keeps on expanding. And right now, that's it's been a debate for a number of years. There's been new data coming in of the accelerating universe and stuff like this, which was looking good for Nathan. And suddenly last week, there's a guy who's got a new argument for the bouncing universe.
And you have open bets. Here's a bet that by 2020, bioterror or bioerror will lead to 1 million casualties in a single event. Martin Rees is betting yes. No one's betting against him yet.
Well, I think that's interesting. Martin Rees is the astronomer royal of Great Britain. And some of these bets give you information even though no one's taken the other side. Because in this case, it tells you that it's not necessarily the official future that people think that in 18 years' time there will be a million deaths from a single bioterror experience, but that they're now kind of pinning the possibility space out that far, and people are saying, you know, that could well happen. It'll be interesting to see if someone eventually does take the other side of that bet. Martin Rees has just put up $1,000, and as you say, it's an open bet, so anyone's able to step up with a persuasive argument on the other side and put their money down.
Stuart Brand, is your hope in putting up the long bets format that this will tighten up our thinking about the future, bring more discipline to it?
I think it could, especially these days with fast-moving technology and stuff. There's a lot of hand-waving predictions that are made from rostrums everywhere and in articles everywhere, and by year X, Y will have happened, and people kind of hear it and sometimes, you know, act on it. But they almost never go back and revisit those predictions, revisit who made them, why they made them, what was going on, who was right, who was wrong. And all this is doing is kind of closing the loop on the whole process of prediction making.
Stuart Brand, you've got us all thinking. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great pleasure.
Stuart Brand is one of the founders of the Long Bets Foundation. If you're feeling really lucky, you can check out the foundation's website, longbets.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBU.